Here in Studio 360, we use a digital editing system called Pro Tools to make the show exactly 59 minutes long. Now, of course, we take out most of the excess ums, uhs, and random coughs, but sometimes we take out entire sentences or paragraphs within the conversations. With the tools available on this program, I suppose we could just speed everything up. So we'd talk faster and faster and faster, 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 and then we'd have no problem fitting ourselves into 1 hour, and we could probably talk for an hour and a half, or maybe 2 hours, and we could make 3 hours fit into one. But it probably wouldn't sound natural. And there are plenty of other little tricks that we choose not to use. Like, if I wanted to, I could sound like I'm at the far end of a huge cathedral.
Or I could shift the pitch of my voice to sound like a tiny little talking church mouse.
I could even harmonize my voice so I sound like a character from a bad movie about aliens. Today we are looking at all the tools we need to make the things we want to create. And my guest is the great film and sound editor Walter Murch. He is one of the most sought-after editors in the business. He began cutting sound in movies in 1969 for Francis Ford Coppola's film The Rain People using a razor blade and tape. And last year, he edited Cold Mountain on an Apple computer using software called Final Cut Pro. That work was up for an Academy Award a few weeks ago. Walter Murch, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much.
Could you start by describing as understandably as you can what a film editor does?
It's a gigantic jigsaw puzzle that we're presented with. But even more than that, it's as if you had 20 or 40 jigsaw puzzles dumped on the floor, and you had to then sort through all the pieces and put together a single coherent picture. So it's down to our kind of our dowsing instinct to choose the best pieces, but more than that, the best pieces that are good in relationship to each other. There is also the, I guess you would call it the fingering element, like the way somebody plays a piece of music, mm-hmm. that the tone and the quality of the actual succession of images and sounds is something that the editor performs in very much the same way that the violinist will perform in a violin concerto, that how those images actually collide with each other down to the micro unit of the frame is something that is also in the responsibility of the editor.
How have your tools as a film editor changed over the years, and how have they changed the way you do your work?
Well, the tools themselves have probably changed as much as anything in the whole area of filmmaking. Back in 1965, when I started out, it was kind of a technological version of what we all did at kindergarten. Mm-hmm. We were working with paper and pencils and crayons and razor blades and scissors and paste and adhesive tape, and we were making these collages, which instead of going up on the kindergarten wall, were actually showing up on the screen in your local theater. Now, it's all done on a computer. And so superficially anyway, we have dispensed with the crayons and the scissors and the knives and the paste and the Scotch tape. On the other hand, the mental process that I was going through in the earlier days is identical to the mental process that I go through when I'm working with a computer.
But I wonder if, given I take my experience as a writer and writing longhand or typing and then having to retype if you decide something is wrong was such a disincentive to change one's mind. And then with word processors, it obviously becomes much easier to change your mind 10 times a minute. I wonder if that analogous change in your profession hasn't changed the way that you and the director can rethink a scene, a moment, a second.
Yes, clearly it has. In fact, it has, to the extent that you have to watch out for that, because the whole creative process can hemorrhage if you don't keep that wound tightly bound. We have the ability to save every single version of the film every day or every hour or every minute. And yet, if you did that, you would very quickly overwhelm your own mental ability to process the information. The analogy certainly is true with writing. I think even to go further back in time, if you compared it to the revolution that happened back in the 15th, 16th century with the invention of oil painting, prior to that, most pictorial art was done as a fresco. And fresco is various tints and dyes applied directly to plaster as it's drying. And the tints soak into the plaster, and as they dry, they actually change color slightly. So you're working at one remove from the final result, and you are very much bound by that inability to change it once it's been put up on the wall. With oil painting, first of all, you didn't have to do it on the wall. You could carry the canvas around with you. And if you didn't like how that fingernail turned out, you could just paint over it with the same facility that we paint over, sort of sense, something on a computer or erase a word and replace it with something else. And arguably, this unleashed a torrent of creativity in the early years. If you look at what happened to painting in the early 1400s, 1500s, the whole development with Leonardo and Raphael and everything was by this excitement of discovering this new technology.
Just pretty much at the same moment that the new tool of the printing press was allowing something beyond the pre-printing press commitment to illuminated manuscript to presumably allow the same kind of fluidity of creation.
Yeah. But there's a dark side to that fluidity, which is that it puts more and more control into a single person's hand. And as painting evolved over the next 300 or 400 years, more and more we got to where we got in the late 19th century, which was painting as the vision of a single tortured artist who was able to do it all himself. Impossible in the days of fresco painting. Fresco was the equivalent of staging the assault of a multi-million dollar movie that involved very complex technologies and many, many people and the participation of the studio, which in a sense was the Catholic Church, vetting all of the images and approving how those images went together. By the time we get to somebody like Van Gogh in the late 19th century, we're peering into the brain of this single individual and looking at what it is that's obsessing him. And there's a danger in that, which is that the image itself can turn into a kind of black hole, which informs the individual to a high degree and maybe helps the individual therapeutically, but is completely inaccessible to other people who look at it. They just can't make anything out of it.